Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to A Word with Tom Merritt. Me, I'm Tom Merritt, and this is the show where I get the pleasure and privilege of sitting down with some of the smartest, most interesting people in the world to talk about how we think about things, because none of us can know everything. It's good to compare notes on how we're thinking about all this different stuff. These are the kinds of conversations I've been having all my life. I grew up having them with my grandpa Carl in his front room, my grandma Roxy in her front room, and I got lots of different ways of looking at the world and great conversations, all leading me to this moment right now. Now, welcome into the front room, Matt Donnelly.
Thank you so much. After that intro, I feel like I'm not qualified to be here.
Everybody says that, and I don't know why. They don't even know my grandparents.
Good point.
How's it going, man? It's good to have you here.
I'm great. I'm so happy to be here. I'm flattered to you asked, and big fan. So thanks for having me.
Before we get to the word, thank you. Before we get to the word, tell folks a little bit about yourself, Ice Cream Social, what you do, etc.
So I host a podcast called Matt and Manling's Ice Cream Social. It's me and another Vegas comedian, as well as an audio guy who's also very funny. And we just kind of shoot the breeze about the living in Las Vegas and the weirdness of our entertainment and strange town that we live in.
It's good times. If folks want to enjoy themselves, check out Ice Cream Social. What led you to do that in the first place?
So I started off as a podcast co-host for Penn Sunday School, and that happened because I started off as an intern for Penn and Teller and then became a comedy writer for Penn and Teller, and then after that he started as co-host and I became a co-host of his podcast. And at the time he was only doing one a week, and from there, when I was doing the podcast with Penn, he was only doing it once a week, and I was like, I was a podcast listener before I was a podcast co-host, and I was like, I bet people need more than that. And I had a comedy partner where we were doing a two-person improv show called The Bucket Show, and we decided to just start podcasting. And now we're coming up on our 10th anniversary, and we've done over 1,000 episodes, and it's been a blast.
Well, the word that I picked, and unlike most of my guests, Matt said, just tell me the word, and we'll run with it. So I'm revealing it to all of you at the same time. The word I picked, and this is going to seem so on the nose, improvisation.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, I started doing improv when I was 15 years old. I both went to a performing arts high school where there was improv exercises in that class. But more importantly, a guy named Mike O'Keefe started this thing called Improv Jam every Friday and Saturday night on the weekends. And so to get permission from your parents to stay out till like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, knowing that you were going to an improv show instead of a party, I fell in love with the idea of doing improv and started performing every Friday and Saturday night, my junior and senior year of high school. And that's how I started improv.
How do you define improv? Because I imagine most of the people in our audience know, like, oh, it's the comedy thing where you don't have stuff planned. How do you define it?
No, I think it's more nuanced than that. I think it's trying to enter a fluid state of co-creation with a group of people, right? And so you can have skills just like, you know, I think the jazz musician thing is more apropos, right? You have skills, you've played scales, you know songs, and so you're bringing your actual experience to the co-creation. So it's not that it's so pure that you're making up every little bit, but, you know, if I'm, you know, sitting in with someone playing bass and someone plays a little riff from Girl from Ipanema and we can do a different minor key version of that together and we discovered that together. We both know Girl from Ipanema, but we discovered that moment together and the audience is as happy that we did, right?
Yeah.
So I think
I feel like that's a key part of it, is the audience kind of getting to be discovering things along with you.
Yeah, it's a shared moment, right? I think the audience knows when you're actually discovering something in the moment and playing with it versus when you're relying on stuff that's not necessarily like pre-planned. You know, it's tough. Like, a lot of people are familiar with Whose Line Is It Anyway, right?
Yeah, sure.
And so those games, I started off playing those games, right? And those games, there just becomes a good way to play them and a bad way to play them. And so even though you're making up the content, sometimes the game can unfold the same way every time. And so that's where I leaned in the late 90s, early 2000s into the thing called long form improvisation. And so where you just honestly take like a one word suggestion, i.e. like this podcast, and you make up a whole piece about it. And so you are creating characters, your who, what, and where, and you're doing a montage of scenes. And then even there can be a performance structure, like how many scenes you're going to do, that kind of thing. But you still are much more fluid and much more able to discover so many more things. And the audience seems to appreciate that. So they seem to love watching the total discovery happen in front of their eyes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's things like comedy sports and improv games and all these things around it. It makes me wonder if there is a similar attraction for the audience to watching improv as there is to game shows, right? Because you're playing along with your head. In your head.
I mean. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Sometimes you get people so dedicated to wanting to be improv comics, right, that they take every class and they take notes. And I always remind them, you know, your job is to risk your ass. You know, like that's the reason why people are coming into the building. So you don't want to have it figured out within an inch of what you're doing. You know, you want to unleash something visceral on that stage. You want the audience to know you're taking a leap of faith.
Yeah. And what do you think makes it work when it works? Because it doesn't always work. That's kind of the nature of the game. But what is the ideal improv situation for you?
Oh, you know, I think that there's something about the service of comedy that I think is very vital, whether we're talking about improv or stand-up or sketch or podcasts or whatever. I think that we are celebrating our imperfection. I believe we're telling ourselves it's okay to not be perfect. You know, when I taught improv a lot, I used to say that drama says there's a hero in all of us, and comedy says, no, there's not, but it's okay. Right.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think no matter what, you're creating relatable characters who are basically kind of suffering. So whether you're doing a sitcom or a movie, they're suffering their company, right? Like something awkward, inappropriate, or unfortunate is happening to them, and they are misdealing with it instead of properly dealing with it, and that creates comedy.
Yeah, and as somebody who enjoys watching it, there's a little bit of how are they going to get themselves out of this one that makes it sing too, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of like being an improv comic is like selling the idea that you can get out of it and then failing, right?
Uh-huh.
So like you know, that's how you get the waves of laughter, is you keep kind of poking towards resolution and then ripping it away from the audiences in one way or another.
Yeah, I don't know if people have really thought about the idea that a perfect improv in some sense would not be enjoyable. Like if someone just got up and told a well-told story from beginning to end, that's not very funny, is it?
No. As a matter of fact, when I would the first exercise I would do when I taught classes in New York was I would make everyone get up and tell the story of their first kiss. And because everyone's first kiss is awkward, everyone's first kiss is like a wealth of emotion and expectations and lack of experience and practice and everything else. And so what happens is everyone tells a charming story. Everyone tells a charming story where everyone laughs. And so I always say, before we get into technique, before we get into, you know, how we're going to co-create scene work with each other, like just know that you are a likable, funny person, you know, because that I found that to be like a great icebreaker.
Oh yeah. Have you ever had someone stand up and go, I've never kissed anyone. I'm sorry. I can't tell the story.
I always say, by your own definition. So it could be the first time you held hands, you know, could be the first time you did whatever. Yeah. And let me get out of it. However, I used to teach at the New York Film Academy, and you got people from all different countries that saw war and things like that. So once in a while, you did get a dramatic first kiss story, you know. And so for those, I would just, you know, say thank you for taking a risk in our classroom. Thank you for being vulnerable to take that risk, you know, and just, you know, appreciate that, that they actually want to share that with us.
Yeah. The idea of improvisation is interesting too, because it's what we're all doing every day. You know, you don't script out your, you know, relationship with the grocery store clerk or the friend you meet on the street or anything.
Well, the lie that we tell ourselves is you take improv classes because you want to get back into that childlike state of play where you used to just let your imagination run wild. But now I have two children and I listen to them play with their friends and they're terrible at it. So I don't know why we sell
it's childlike.
That. Yeah. but that is exactly the truth. I mean, you are talking about, like, improv theaters are open in every state of our nation, right? And and a lot of them are still thriving even post pandemic, and a lot of them are still thriving for all these years. And it's not because they all mint people that get on the Saturday Night Live every year.
Sure.
It is a social deal. I think it does make you a better listener, a better storyteller. So you say that we all improv through life. I think it does make you better at improvising your way through life. A lot of times, like, giving people the authority to identify that they're having an awkward conversation and that they have every right to change the subject and everyone in the room will be relieved. That's a big performance note, but that's a big life note as well, you know?
Yeah.
So the freedom to not get stuck in conversations you don't want to have is a huge freedom. And that does come from improv training for me.
There are definitely things you can do on stage that you probably don't think you can do in real life. Do you have examples where you took that lesson into the real world?
I will just tell you that awkwardly that, like, you know, there are always times where people are in a bad situation and they say, "Oh, I wish I would have said this," or "I wish I would have said that." And I've had situations where I did say that and I did do that, and it's not better. It's you rather walk away with regret than saying horrible things to people or really insulting someone on the spot when it's just awkward. It's really awkward.
Are all your examples ones that you would rather not relive, I'm guessing? Or
I remember, like, a guy was like, you know, there's a big boxing match letting out, and I was walking through a casino and a bunch of people, and I was trying to get away, go to a show, and we bumped shoulders, and he was like, "Oh, you tough?" And I go, "Are you serious right now? You're the guy who literally got out of a boxing match, bumped shoulders, and you're going to start a fight with someone because you just got out of a fight because you watched two guys who can actually fight? Get over yourself." And it was, like, really awkward. It was just so, it did not feel good.
It sounds great, actually, right? It's a story. It's like, "Oh, man, that's awesome. I wish I'd have been Matt Donnelly in that moment." But no. You don't wish you had been Matt Donnelly in that moment.
I'd say, like, one time, like, the example that comes to mind was, like, I remember I was trying to, I had this job where I was working for Guinness World Records Gone Wild was a show on True TV for a minute.
Wow, nice.
And I was doing the thing that people do out here where you lie that you live in LA when you live in Las Vegas. And so I was commuting on the weekends back home, and so I was driving in the middle of the night and flying through the desert, like flying through or whatever, and I came zooming up over a hill and on a downhill, and on the downhill I passed right by a police officer, highway patrolman, and slammed my brakes and looked down, slamming my brakes. Post slam I was going 100 miles an hour.
Oh, wow.
So the lights come on. And he,
of course,
and he, you know, pulls me right over, and he has got a head of steam in him. And he says, "Do you know how fast you were going?" And I didn't want to admit that I must have been over 100 miles an hour. So I just said, "Fast." And he goes, "Any reason for you to be going that fast on the highway in the middle of the night?" And I said, "Honestly, officer, is there a good reason for anyone to be traveling at the speed I was going?" And he was so disarmed and frustrated. I thought I was doing a good thing, but he still gave me every ticket. Like, he just skipped the berating. I disarmed the berating. but still.
Yeah. And so it didn't do you any good.
No.
In the end result, but it may have sped up the process.
Yeah. It might have saved us both 20 minutes.
Yeah. May you think you would have been a little more thankful for that. Or I don't know. Maybe that was his fun, and you cheated him of his fun.
That's I might have deprived him of his anger dopamine.
Yeah. I definitely did that to a bicyclist once. I was driving in San Francisco. A very strong bike culture. I also was a bicyclist, and I was turning and started to turn, and someone was in one of those bike lanes going straight. And didn't wait for me to turn, right?
Yes.
And then got really angry at me. My window was down because it was hot that day, and was like, "You need to watch." And I said, "Yes, you're absolutely right." And they were just so angry. They were like, "Fuck you." And they just took off.
They don't know what to do. I've
definitely done that. You can't deprive people of their outrage. That's a good one.
I had the same exact scenario happen with a cyclist, and I was with a friend. I was in the passenger seat, and again, he started screaming at us, and we screamed back, whatever. And then he looked at us and he called us, the F word, gay slur, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and I was like, "Why is that okay?" and the cyclist felt authentic guilt.
Really?
Literally was like, "Oh, I shouldn't have." You're right. We shouldn't. I was in Northern California. I think they're more sensitive up there. And they literally were like, "You're right. I shouldn't be calling people that as an insult."
And then you both went out and got beers together, and now he's your comedy partner. That's great. It's how do you have that presence of mind in those situations, though? Because that is the kind of thing that makes good improv, right?
It is
things come to you.
It is years of you want to counter, you want to surprise, you want to go to the offbeat, right? So it's years of like, this is the typical response. Your brain is always saying, you know, especially in improv, right? So when you play games like music games or things like that, you want to. If you're going to make the obvious joke, you want to make it fast. You want to make it as fast as it's coming to the audience's mind. So if you can beat them to the punch to the most obvious joke, you still get points and they still laugh. If you save that for your second joke, they groan because they saw it coming or whatever.
Right. And so the surprise is a big element of comedy. So you want
to. Totally.
Yeah.
And so if you feel like they are expecting it, you can counter the other way. I have a lifetime of a brain of like, how do I go to the other way? So I don't know why in that moment I'm in an insult battle, and but I was authentically struck when he called us that, because I thought, what's wrong with being a gay couple if we were, and we weren't, but there'd be nothing wrong with it. Yeah. Right. But if you can surprise people by going like, "Oh, come on," that's really what it's all about. So yeah, because I do solo comedy magic as well, and the same thing when I'm interacting with the audience, I want to find a way to make something happen that's so distinct in the room that night that they know that only happened that night.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Do you think it's something that you can learn, or is it just something you hone? Right? Are there people whose brains just are predisposed to that kind of talent, and they can get better at it, or is it something anybody like, do these five things and you can pick up that trick?
I think I've gotten this question before, and it's always a little complicated. I think that One, you can always, the honing is a great way to, no, I've never heard that before, and that's a great way to phrase it. Honing is like, yes, I was a wise ass in school. I got kicked out of class all the time for making jokes. And so when I found improv, it was like a heavenly light beacon went off.
Yeah.
This is where I belong. You get
rewarded for the thing you were getting kicked out of class for.
Yeah. And then it made me much better in class. It made me a better student. I ended up becoming president of my class and president of my school.
So oh, wow. No
I really, yeah. So I really, yeah. I really just turned it around. Because it also gave me a lot of self-esteem and everything else, right? And I think, like, you know, to go for a moment to like a nerdier answer, you know, there's this guy, Paul Sills, who started Second City, originally was the Compass in Second City. And that's kind of the modern improv that we understand today. We're not going back to ancient Commedia dell'arte in Italy or anything like that. His mother wrote, the book on improvisation, literally the book of improvisation. And when she did it, she was just a theater director and a theater teacher. And during the post-depression WPA works programs for artists, she went into work camps to teach improv to teens and adults to help build self-esteem and to help co-create. Mm-hmm. And it was a service. It wasn't meant to be, hey, we're going to get on stage. It was her son who decided, you know, this stuff on stage would be funny. Yeah. And so on a primary level, I think it does just make things better. Like, I think comedy is in all of us. And so anytime we're honing our communication skills, it is going to make us funnier. I think for it to be like a performance thing, I think you have to have a certain self-awareness.
Hmm.
Like, if you tell a joke and it bombs and you know it bombs, then you can get funnier, right? But we all know people who tell a joke at bombs and they go, oh, come on, that's funny.
The audience is wrong. Yeah.
They're going to have a harder time. You know? Yeah. I used to tell this thing where I say, if you're sitting in a diner, you know, and one person's talking about, you know, gathering resources and people to go to some hurricane ravaged nation and see if they can reestablish some infrastructure there, and on the other table to your other side, someone's getting caught cheating on their wife, and the wife is laying out the details of how she knows he might be cheating. Which conversation do you think you'll eavesdrop on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always say, if you're worried about that hurricane ravaged country, you're gonna have a harder time being a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people, they go for the emotion, the guilty pleasured emotion, and so
yeah.
And I feel like if you're in touch with that, if you're in touch with that connection you have with the audience, their emotion, you can get a lot funnier than you are now.
There's a certain amount of empathy, it sounds like, is what you're describing.
Yeah. I think you have to be, there has to be something kind of universal, you know, about what you're relating to. And then, you know, John Cleese always had like a metaphor about like making a sharp turn versus a wide turn. Like if you turn too quickly, the audience just blows right past you. Mm-hmm. And if you turn too late, they saw it coming and they don't care for it. So you're always trying to make this turn, this move at some point where you have a sense of the audience's collective experience in your head.
Yeah. So you don't lose them, but
right.
But you still surprise them.
Yeah.
It's a kind of empathy. We often use empathy to mean, you know, being compassionate, but empathy doesn't have to be. It's a kind of empathy that can be used against your audience for their entertainment, of course.
Oh, of course. No, another thing about it is the co-creation element, right? Like mm-hmm. the idea of what you want to do in improv, whether you are a musician or a comedian, is you want to do it with a group. You want to do it with a crew. You know, you want to achieve as a team. And that involves just a whole different language. And so that part the part that's, I think it's the most like overlooked aspect of it. Cause everyone always thinks about, I will take an improv class or can you teach me improv? And the whole idea of what you're actually looking for is like another artist who mm-hmm. shares a certain amount of sensibilities, but also challenges a certain amount of sensibilities so that you create different stuff, you know?
Yeah. And there's an empathy between the two of you of a sort, right? Where you know what that person's strengths is and where they're going to go, and you can help each other along the way.
Like my comedy partner that I do Ice Cream Social with, Paul Mattingly, like it was like really strange and magical because I was in two improv groups in New York where we were together forever. A lot of them were like, and you know, we're in each other's weddings, that kind of stuff. But I moved to Las Vegas because my wife booked Jersey Boys. And so we live in Las Vegas now. And this guy, Paul, called me up because I tried to get a commercial agent. So that commercial agent put us together. He called me up and said, we're doing an improv show. Come on by. I went out that night, to this little tiny theater, in the back of a sex shop in Las Vegas where they sold different, delightful toys for,
it's Las Vegas, what
for exploratory people. Exactly. It was like a perfect
probably
introduction.
Not surprising, really.
No, not at all. And we did a couple scenes together at the end of the night, and like they had like a jam, and then we did a couple scenes together, and people came up to us that night and were like, how long have you guys been performing together? And so we literally, you know, fell in artistic love with each other. You know, we started performing that night and every time we could since, and then eventually started doing a two-person show on our own.
And it was love at first, yes, and.
It really was. It really was. And he has a totally different sensibilities of both life and a totally different sensibilities from where he trained. Like, we have totally different improv training backgrounds and totally different kind of like artistic backgrounds. And it's because we both have been performing for so long. We both saw guys who do something very different, but make bold choices. And we just liked the challenge of working with each other so much that we've been at it ever since.
It seems like you need to have partners that are different. If you're all the same, that's not going to work.
Right.
What are the things you think need to be the same?
Oh, I think you need to have a sense of, you need to agree on, there's kind of a balance in improv of how theatrically sound do you want the pieces you create to be, and how funny they are. And so I think we both agree to kind of start slow and grounded and then ramp up, you know, that kind of thing. So like we both agree on sharing that sensibility, for an audience, I think. I don't know if there's a way to totally put all the words on it, but I think you just have to kind of get a sense that you enjoy the work that you create with each other and the audience does too.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could have two people who don't care what the audience thinks, right? And then that's also fine.
And that could be good. Yeah. But, I was fascinated by what you were saying earlier about it having its roots in education, because I think a lot of people understandably think, oh, improv, that's people who want to get up on stage, you know, and entertain people. Yeah. But it's interesting to think of its roots as being just self-improvement.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, when I've taught, like, you know, at corporations and done those more kind of big corporate gigs. And one of the things that comes up when you talk about improv is you know, you can bring up the armed forces, right? And how when you go out into battle, you have your training, but then you are definitely improvising together, right?
Right.
And even in that, they're actually taught, in the military to not say the word but. Mm-hmm. In conversation, because it confuses and muddies things. So they actually have a yes and kind of conversation happening with the way you communicate on the battlefield. So, you know, in high stakes situations, it's about function. It's about finding a way to function together, for sure.
Yeah. And that's a valuable skill applicable in lots of other arenas. I know that, you know, you could do a whole course, and you have done a whole course on improv. I imagine there's people listening who want a couple of tips. So if you'll suffer them, you know, for maybe even what don't do, what not to do if you're trying to do improv.
Well, I'll say, like, I actually always encourage people, like, when if your town or somewhere near your town has an improv class to offer, I always say, go ahead and take it, because everyone is taking the same risk. So you think you're the new person and you're going to walk into a bunch of, you know, people who have been doing it forever. They don't take level one, who people have been doing it forever. So you are going to meet a bunch of people from different walks of life all taking the same risk. And that creates a really cool experience. It's a great way if you move from town to town. I feel like taking an improv class is a good way to, like, find people in town. So when you take a class, most people, when they put on the spot, they think they have to be interesting, you know? And so they usually say something perverted or something, dangerous, like they're going to murder or kill, kind of thing or whatever. And because those things put tension in the room. So I would just say, remember that laughter is a reaction to tension, but how you handle things creates a lot more tension than you think it does. So a lot of times just simply behaving and being someone can create a whole bunch of tension, and you let that come to you. You will not accidentally do improv drama. You won't accidentally accomplish a Hamlet scene or a Shakespeare scene. Something will go wrong. Mm-hmm. So it's about trusting that that moment's going to come and to play with it in the moment, you know?
Yeah.
So I would say bold, simple, playful. Try to make a bold choice, keep it nice and simple, and then be very playful with it is always my goal when I hit the stage.
Yeah. Don't threaten to murder the audience just to get a reaction.
No, I think, you know, it's always like, I always say, go for the most personal conversation you can think of having, right? Like, Dad, I don't want to go to college, you know, will you marry me? Those things, like, go to those. If you have a moment, that's what will always surprise an audience. They know that you're going to do something funny. So if you start somewhere meaningful, that's the first surprise you're going to give the audience. It's like, oh, they're going to do something deeper here. And once you have a deep moment, there's 1,000 ways to make it go wrong. There's 1,000 ways to make it funny. So I always say, just go for a real moment first, and then it's just the comedy becomes much easier.
What are those ways of going wrong?
I think so. I teach a technique called bull matador, because I was so struck by the notion that we make improv training this individual thing when it's about co-creation. And so bull matador is that, like, you got to have both in a scene, right? So if you have two guys who really want to be funny, and they just come out, they're both trying to play the quirkiest characters or whatever. You can do things where, like, hey, I'm home, I killed the baby. And you're like, oh, funny, I'm making a baby soup. Now you've established a world where killing babies is A-okay. So where the heck is the tension going to come from? Mm-hmm. Like, if that's okay, then what isn't okay? Like, how are you going to create tension? You know? And sure, there's some comedic genius answer for that in the moment, maybe. But for the most part, that's a hard time for everyone in the room. You know? And so you have bull. No one's being struck by any of the information. That's always a big thing for me as both an improviser and a solo comedy magician. If you can be struck by the information you're receiving, then that creates a huge interest in the audience. And so you always want to be struck by people. So, and then if you have two people who are very patient actors who are just willing to just, like, do a scene of, like, two guys sitting on a porch talking about nothing, you have two matadors there. Nothing's coming towards each other.
Right? Yeah. You don't make any progress then.
Yeah. So I said it earlier, but you want something, like, awkward, inappropriate, unfortunate to happen to someone, and that person must suffer the company they have in the scene. And so, you figure out whether you are the causing of suffering or the sufferer, and you kind of counter back and forth.
And can that switch during the course of things too?
Yes. Typically if someone divulges or confesses something. Mm-hmm. If someone divulges or confesses what they really feel about something, or seem apologetic, then they have to become the sufferer, and the other person must amplify something to cause the suffering.
Going back to what you were saying at the very beginning about jazz, which I think is a great example of improvisation that people don't think about. We always think about comedy. I'm trying to rack my brain for other examples of that. Can you think of other examples that aren't comedy or jazz where improvisation is central to what's being done?
I mean, only out of ignorance, I don't know if I can. Those are just the two examples I go to. I think there's very few. After that, I'm trying to think of, like, group art, right? Like, I'm trying to think of other examples where
performance art.
Yeah.
Some kinds of performance art.
Right. I'm trying to think of, like, we don't ever, because also you're in on the process, right? So when you don't often watch the process of a painter or watch, and Bob Ross didn't have someone come in and also be like, well, I'm going to put a tree over here too. Right. You know, I can't think of examples of co-creation of physical art.
It does seem like a fairly unique skill, like a skill, but something that isn't, and maybe should be used in more places. I don't know. I don't know if I want to use it used in law enforcement necessarily, but there might be other places where it would be good.
No, I mean, I remember it was, like, an older comedian was, like, complaining, like, about how, like, improv had taken over the comedy world. And he was like, and now writers' rooms are nice, And like, and then when you go on, like, even when you go on talk shows and stuff, it's not this ruthless environment that it once was in the old days of like Carson and early Letterman and those kinds of things.
I mean, talk shows are pretty planned, but there's some room for improvisation and that sort of thing too.
You're going to find a lot of people with improv backgrounds behind
comedic talk
shows and sitcoms. And then in those, and then the technique does work with that as well. And I guess we are leaving out sports as your
Sure. No, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sports is definitely worth it. I mean, that's the definition of having a game plan but having to react to so many factors that it becomes a loose plan and not a big plan.
Yeah. I mean, I immediately my mind goes to baseball cuz I'm a big baseball fan, but you know, the guy that steals the base without the sign and, you know, puts the team in position to win the game, improv that, right?
Right. Or you lay your pitching lineup, right? So this is the order which the relievers are going to come in, and one guy gets shelled and suddenly that order has to go out the window,
right? Tear up the plan. Yeah.
Or you went into, you know, extra innings the night before. And you can't do that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. But man, this was really fun chatting with you about this. And we always finish these episodes with a little game called This or That, where I will just present two options and you tell me which you would pick and why.
Okay, great.
The first one, Stalin or Genghis Khan?
Just any arbitrarily? Just anything we're into?
Yeah, for any reason.
Genghis Khan, because of the gene pool. Not only did he affect actual conquering, but he actually, I think there's a crazy amount of people still related to Genghis Khan.
Right. Like most people on Earth are related to Genghis Khan.
Stalin did not do that.
Yeah. And Genghis Khan, I mean, it's unfair because of time, but Genghis Khan has a longer legacy.
Right.
You know, Stalin's too recent. He's just an up and comer. Arms or tentacles?
Oh, tentacles. You've ever seen footage of the octopus opening up a jar from the inside, that he's inside a jar? Oh, there's just so much more to do. So much more to take care of.
Even if you only have two tentacles.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, if we replace our arms with tentacles, a couple of awkward weeks, and then I think no regrets after that.
Yeah, it just becomes normal, and everybody loves it. And people with arms, you know, they're looked on with sympathy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you couldn't afford a tentacle upgrade.
They're like, you also opened the jar of pasta sauce. Good job, buddy.
Fast or slow zombies?
Oh, slow zombies. I'm slow. I need time to think. I'm not a naturally violent person, so I have to gather my muster. I'll take slow zombies any day.
This has become a litmus test for personality, I've found, is that the people who say fast zombies are like, oh, they're more exciting, right? They're about, like, what's going to entertain me? The people who say slow zombies, like yourself, are thinking more practically, like, no, I want to be able to get away.
I will. If they're fast zombies, I will enjoy my first fast zombie, and that's about it.
Right.
Then I am a fast zombie.
Savory or dessert crepes?
Oh, you know, all the way up until you said the word crepes, I was saying savory, and then you said the word crepe, and it's so standard, but I don't think there's anything better than a Nutella banana crepe.
So good. And you might be surprised to learn you're in the minority of the people I've talked to.
Oh, that's – I think people are trying to impress you. I think they want to sound interesting.
Maybe. I'm a little suspicious about the number of people who've said savory.
I'm going to take all those people out to a crepe shop.
They're always like, oh, yeah, the basil and butter. And I'm like, really?
Stop
not
it.
Not banana. Not Nutella. I mean, I should have just brought up Nutella every time.
Because
to me it felt like, oh, it's everybody's going to say dessert. It'll be interesting to see the people who say savory. Yeah. Open mic or karaoke?
Oof. Karaoke, the highs and lows are just shallower. Open mic, the highs are very high at an open mic, but the lows are very low at an open mic.
You like the more limited boundary of karaoke.
Yeah. Also, like most songs in karaoke are not 5 minutes, and every set at open mic is 5 minutes.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. That's a good point. I never thought about that. Like five minutes is an eternity, and karaoke is always 3:30, right?
Early on in karaoke, I chose a song longer than 5 minutes, and I was like, what am I doing? And I now always look at the time of the song before I choose it to make sure.
Bohemian Rhapsody, Inagata Davila, don't,
pump up the jam. It's surprisingly longer than you think it is. Yeah.
Dogs or cats?
I have cats, but I didn't choose to have cats. We inherited cats.
I see.
Through a death in the family.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. We're talking about cats and dogs still. So I have cats, and cats are fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I used to always joke that, like, if a guy was having girl trouble, and forgive me for being binary about it, but if a guy's having girl trouble, he should get cats, because cats really teach you about the random times that it's on and it's off. And you just, and when you enter a flow state of whenever it's on, it's off, you're much better at dealing with the social situations. And I always say women should get dogs, because when you just, a dog just wants to be so happy, will get angry in a second, is super loyal, wants to be occupied, gets easily sad when you walk away, like just dealing with like that nature.
I mean, you've got the makings of a self-help.
Instead of Venus and Mars, it's just cats and dogs. But I made a promise to my children. You know, I work around the country. As soon as I can work in Vegas, that I say we will get a dog. I think I still like dogs.
Yeah,
I just haven't gotten one in a while because my wife and I are both in show business, and we have to leave all the time. Yeah.
And the cats are more useful around the house on their own than the dogs.
Yes, they really. I always say, like, I don't have cats. I cohabitate a place with cats.
Yeah.
They look at me like a pet as well. Like, they're like, we're here, you're here. They seem to look at me like we're on equal footing.
You can't spell cohabitate or fascinate without cat.
True.
It's a fact, folks.
Take that. Take that, dogs.
Can't spell God without dog, says the dog right back. Beef or chicken?
I'm a beef guy. I mean, I try not to have as much of it as I used to, but in terms of like treating yourself, although, yeah, I do. I've had some good chicken as well.
I feel like I choose chicken because I feel like I should. You know, less fat, less cholesterol, all that.
Yeah.
But I'm probably with you. If I'm not worried about that beef.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Last one, hot or cold?
Hot.
You're a Vegas person. That's
yes. I live in Las Vegas, and I my body knows how to deal with being hot better than it does know how to deal with being cold.
That's a better way of answering that. A lot of people are like, oh, if you're hot, you can't cool down. Or if you're cold, you can't heat up. But it's just what your body can deal with better. I'm a hot person too.
Yeah, yeah. My wife, we moved to Las Vegas. It's a good thing because when we were dating in New York and New Jersey, she'd come out to my house in New Jersey. We were just dating. And she would always have to put on the space heater at like any temperature. But if it ran too long, it would trip the breaker.
Oh,
and
no.
So in the middle of the night, our entire house would become frigid cold. And I was like, I have to stop. Like, we're going to break up if I don't stop. We just have to stop meeting here. it was too high stakes. Her cold was not happy at all. And I was like, my wife is definitely a hot person, which also is maybe why I'm a hot person.
Yeah. It makes it easier, you know,
to
cohabitate with the cats.
God's
well,
will.
Matt Donnelly, thank you so much for sitting down and chatting with me. It was fun to just go in it cold with the word. And if folks want to find Ice Cream Social, anything that you do, where should they go?
They should go to heyscoops.com or look for Ice Cream Social on any podcast player. And just know that Tom said a word that made me nerd out immediately. Like Tom said a word that I've dedicated decades of my life to teaching. We're much more irreverent and silly on our.
That's true. I hope they don't go like, oh, I'm going to get a sober class in improvisation by listening to
We do get
you're going to have a lot of fun. I'll back you on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but this was a blast. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Also, thanks to our producer, Anthony Lemos. Thank you for listening to this show and telling your friends about it. You can get an ad-free version of this show with Acast Plus. Click on Access Exclusive Content at awordpodcast.com, and we'll have a word with you next time.
The DTNS family of podcasts, helping each other understand.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.